The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Hurricane Harvey spikes gas prices. Markets snap weekly loss streak. The Jackson Hole Economic Confab reveals nothing new. And our guest today, Paul Moore from Wellings Capital, on how to lose money. All this and much more on episode number 523 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. As John Oliver would say, welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz, not John Oliver. And as you know, we come together each and every week to talk about all things financial, from the far areas of crazy economic conditions somewhere in the world, maybe emerging markets, to right here in the domestic markets, what's happening from an economic standpoint, the markets, cryptocurrencies, which I'm going to talk about in a second, real estate, which we have a great guest on for today, lots of areas that we cover, all to make sure that you have not only an education in the areas that are important to understand, but also more importantly, to get some ideas on how to make you some money. You know, in my first book, I have two books out, in The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success, which by the way, you can get on audiobook over on Amazon, on Audible. There's plenty of places to grab that, so you can just look that up. You know, it has a couple of things in there that, for example, we did some really great work on quantitative screens, which, you know, we use the, when the book was written, we used the Microsoft Money Central screening tools. Now, you don't have to use those. You could use any of the screening tools that are out there, either from a package that you have a subscription to, or FinViz, or there's a variety of places where you can get these screening packages. So even though the Microsoft Money Central is not available anymore, and we reference that in the book, how to use it, it's the same technique to go to finding a screening process in order to find, let's call it, the dogs of the Dow, or GARP, growth as at a reasonable price, or maybe either even go-go momentum stocks. That's how you start out the process. And one of the things that we do on a regular basis is we utilize screens. We utilize a variety of ways to find some stocks that may be either undiscovered, unloved, or maybe even looking like they're going to continue on with a growth strategy process, whereas we have things like return on equity and earnings growth momentum that is consistent and revenues growth momentum that's consistent. And we look for these things utilizing a screen because a lot of times you have to wonder, where do I get those ideas? Not me, but you. Where do you get those ideas? Where do I find the stocks that I want to invest in and investigate and research more? Well, you can do it from just hearing tips on TV and radio shows and newsletters and podcasts and all that. But again, if you want to do some homegrown research and you want to find where are some of the places that you can start from a baseline, you can use a quantitative and a screener system that gives you what you're looking for. Again, whether it's value-oriented stocks, whether it is growth-oriented, whether it's dividend, high dividend plays, these are the ways that you do it. Now, I want to mention that because a lot of times I get in emails from people asking me, like, where do you start? How do I begin? Where do I find? There's so much information that is out there each and every day coming across, whether it's earnings or guidance announcements, whether it's tips, whether it's ideas about news flow and from news flow, but you can do this on a regular basis by setting yourself up, utilizing a quantitative process, a screening process to start uncovering stocks. So I want to mention that because I did see a few emails come through on that. And by the way, if you want to ask any questions, you can just do so very easily by going to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and clicking on the Ask Andrew. And every so often we have a show where we answer listeners' questions. And we're going to do that coming up in a couple of weeks. So make sure to get your questions in there on the Ask Andrew section of thedisciplinedinvestor.com. A quick update on something that I'm pretty excited about. We have a great guest coming up next week, but also I think we're going to have a double guest next week because there's a terrific gentleman who is, I think, just a great trader. He has some interesting insight. I've watched him for years because I subscribe to one of the services that he is actually the senior trader and chief marketing strategist for Briefing.com, Briefing.com trader subscription. And probably over the last few months, I've noticed that he's been talking more and more about cryptocurrencies. And I've been following some of his discussions about this and his actual trading because he does actual trades and shows you where he's going, what he's doing. But he's become quite the expert in the area of cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, Ethereum, Ripple, StoreJ, storage, I think they call it, Eurocoin. Now, what's interesting about this, different than some of the other players out there that are new to the whole trading environment and just new to this very recent cryptocurrency concept of trading, whether the, you know, whatever coins there are, he's been trading for decades. And he has been really, and he has a tremendous amount of technical understanding of markets. And I thought that because he became so involved in this, I would invite him on the show next week to talk about how to get started in cryptocurrency, how to get involved in trading, whether or not you believe it or not. I think there's something to be said for this happening. And we need to know more about this. I have a lot of questions. Talking about where to set up an account, how to actually trade it, what are wallets? Can you go short? How do you fund it? Should I buy Bitcoin or Bitcoin Cash, Bitcoin Lite, Ethereum, Ripple? There's hundreds of these. And how do I make that decision? So we're going to have him on next week. I think you really should make sure to tune in. If you haven't done so already, you can go over to iTunes or a variety of the various podcast services, and you can subscribe to make sure you get that. So I would encourage you to do that. In the old days, we really only had iTunes and the podcast app on the iPhone, but now there's so many out there. But whatever you use for your service, make sure not only to listen to this on the website or, you know, on a one-off basis, make sure to subscribe to make sure you don't miss anything coming up, because we have a lot of really good guests in the near future coming up, as well as I mentioned, the Ask Andrew question and answer listener questions we're going to talk about. Before we get to our current guest today, let's talk about what happened last week. Yes, markets did in fact snap a two-week loss streak on some, I guess, optimism that there's going to be some effort to move forward with this tax reform plan. There was a lot of concern that Gary Cohn would possibly resign, and we found out this week that he actually had a resignation letter. He actually drafted a resignation letter after the whole Charlottesville mess, the week before. And he was thinking about, well, I'm not going to do this anymore as the senior economic and financial advisor to Trump. There was a lot of people already hadn't been resigning and boards disbanded. And, we've seen, if you haven't noticed and read the news, dozens of charitable organizations have canceled their Mar-a-Lago, which is they call it the Southern White House, but the property that Donald Trump owns here in Florida, and a pretty uppity and nice and beautiful facility, just actually gorgeous, that is really great for these events, for fundraisers, and dozens of charities have pulled out of their planned dinner parties, their fundraisers from Mar-a-Lago over what's gone on. So when we look at the concern that was in the markets over Gary Cohn, who is probably going to be one of the either architects of or the White House overseers of the tax plan that would be with Steven Mnuchin and coordinating it with Congress, there was a very big concern. Not only that, there's some talk that Gary Cohn will be on the short list, if not at the top, of the potential for replacements for Janet Yellen if that does come. And we'll talk about the potential for Janet Yellen in a second when we talk about what happened at at Jackson Hole on Friday. But that was an overhang for markets. And now when they came out and Gary Cohn says that, no, he is not resigning. He thought about it, but he's not, because he's not going to allow this to derail his desire to help out the American people, the American economy, and of course, to do his patriotic duty. He did say that he was not happy about what went on. He did comment about his displeasure at how everything was handled, but he said he's going to stay on. Markets reacted very positively to that and recouped a good amount of the losses, or at least part of the losses, over the last 2 weeks that we saw. So that was good. We saw some economic numbers that came out that were probably, I would say, at best, meh. I mean, they weren't great. But there is some silver linings inside of there. Yes, home sales and new home sales and existing home sales fell much shorter than expectations. That was there was no question about that. Durable goods orders were down about 6.8%. That was far more of a drop, a greater drop than was anticipated. However, a majority of that was due to transportation, a slowdown in things like plane sales. And that was kind of expected. If you look inside the numbers and you strip out transportation, actually durable goods orders were up 0.5%, which was more than was expected. And they were up from only up 0.1% last month. So in fact, when you look at the internals of the durable goods orders, while they were lower, what we saw was that many of the components actually were positive for GDP overall, adding to the potential for a higher GDP, or at least a signaling that we're not going to see that much of a slowdown from what we've seen recently. So that was good. So kind of put that on the back of that. And obviously, we had a weaker dollar throughout the week. It started to move higher, but then as soon as Thursday and Friday came, we saw some of the speakers at Jackson Hole. And on Friday, when we saw Janet Yellen and Mario Draghi talk, the euro went, it skyrocketed. I mean, it was up to about 100 and I think 1.19 on the euro. The dollar dropped to support again. And interest rates came in a little bit due to the home sales numbers. And of course, anytime Janet Yellen talks, interest rates start to perk up and then drop a little bit. And by the time she's finished, it's usually realized that she's a bit dovish. But in the speeches by both Draghi and Yellen, there was really no discussion about plans for anything to do with interest rates or monetary policy. They focused on regulations. And if you think about that, they're focusing on regulations and how they don't want to see a massive destruction of many of the regulations that were put in place over the last number of years since the financial crisis, that kind of goes against what is being discussed by the White House. The agenda of the Republicans right now is to take down much of the roadblocks and regulations and areas of, systematic stifling of the opportunities for business. And all of a sudden, Yellen, and by the way, Draghi, they must have had a little talk and a little chat beforehand. This was not done. It's clearly not done separate and apart from each other. There was no question that there was a consolidated effort and a coordinated effort to make sure they didn't talk about policy at this Jackson Hole meeting and to make sure they both were on the same platform about regulations. Now, this puts her at odds with President Trump. And President Trump is the one that will appoint the next Fed chair in 2018. And while Janet Yellen did not say yes, she was definitely in her last speech about the topic of whether or not she would continue on as Fed chair. She did not say, oh, I really want this job. She says, basically whatever happens, I will be fine with. She didn't really have any kind of positive commentary or negative commentary about whether or not she would continue on and her desires. She was just very ambivalent, which I guess is kind of the way of an economist, and gives her at least the opportunity to move back and forth depending on the current environment in Washington. But again, this is very much at odds with what the current administration and Republican majority want to see, which is a reduction in overall regulations. And if she is not going to be friendly to that, we have to then assume that President Trump will, in fact, look to appoint somebody else into that position in 2018. And as the market is pretty happy with the fact that if Gary Cohn, well known for his time at Goldman Sachs, is put into place, he would be very friendly to the business environment. So therefore, at least a transition is not going to be so difficult or different. He'll probably be very friendly to the banks, which is what, of course, we all want a Federal Reserve chief to be. We want the Federal Reserve to be very easy on the economy, of course, to promote growth. This is all things that we believe that Gary Cohn will, in fact, provide. So now that he's staying on, now that we saw some question arise just on Friday about Janet Yellen's potential tenure as the Fed chairperson, this is going to possibly bring up the discussion in the next few months as to the ongoing potential for Gary Cohn to fill those shoes. So keep a watch on that. I think it's going to be a very interesting development over the next few months in terms of how this plays out. And obviously, while Gary Cohn did not resign, and he said he's here to stick it out, I just have to wonder if there are any further concerns, if there is any a significant amount of upheaval from the Charlottesville that pulls forward, and if it's not played correctly by the White House. So I think that there's a lot of care that needs to be placed in this whole situation right now to ensure that Gary Cohn is put into that position if, in fact, Yellen continues with her discussion about keeping all the regulations and fighting the White House and the Republicans. So we'll have to see how that really plays out right now. Let's get to our guest and talk about the topic of real estate. Now, we've talked about real estate before in a variety of ways because real estate is a good portion of a diversified portfolio to help avert a significant amount of overlap. If you just, of course, we know diversification is very important. And there are ways as an investor to get involved in real estate, whether it's REITs or limited partnerships. We're going to really, you know, kind of focus on a different area today and talk about real estate from a position of buying and selling outright. But I don't want to give away a lot of my questions and thoughts on what we're going to talk about. So let's just get right to it. Our guest today is Paul Moore from Wellings Capital, and he has a great podcast entitled, listen to this, How to Lose Money. He's an expert in areas of real estate. We're going to talk about some things, I'm sure, about multifamily and residential and a whole bunch of things. Really good depth of knowledge in this. Paul, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on, Andrew.
So tell me, you know, tell me how you came up with this name, How to Lose Money, and what you, tell people what the podcast is all about.
Well, you know, as I began to, I heard over the years, you know, from lots of fellow investors, entrepreneurs, et cetera, that they had all had these big failure stories. And I heard Bill Gates say that we can learn a lot from success, but we learn so much more from failures. And of course, we've all heard Thomas Edison's famous quote, you know, I found 1,000 ways not to make a light bulb. And so I began to think about this and realize there's all kinds of podcasts out there about how to be successful, how I got rich, how I got all these great things happened to me. But who's talking about their failures? And I asked a lot of people, and everybody I talked to except one or two said they'd be willing to come on the podcast and talk about failures. One of my first guests lost $71 million in the dot-com blow up. And they all have these great lessons they've learned from it. I know I've had a lot of failures over the years, to be super honest. And so I thought, let's just do a podcast talking about that and see what we can learn from it.
You know, it's interesting. So let's talk a little bit about that just for a second here, because, you know, in terms of failures, obviously it's the old process of learning from all the things that you do in life and the accumulation of knowledge in terms of, you know, what works, what doesn't work. And, you know, you got to sometimes stub your toe when you're doing things in order to kind of not stub it the next time on that corner. I mean, is that the whole gist of it, which is basically learning how not to make mistakes from the mistakes that you've made?
Yeah, absolutely. What we're doing is we're taking the knowledge gained from all these different people's multiple mistakes, and we're boiling it down to a few lessons and a few things that we can learn and take away from it. And a whole lot of them just come back to similar themes over and over again. We've done about, I think, 70 or so episodes. And surprisingly, a lot of it comes down to lack of due diligence, lack of selecting the right partner, trusting somebody that was a friend who became an enemy during the course of the business, et cetera.
Yeah. I mean, I know one of the rules I have is not to work with friends. I got to tell you, only because I always say that, you can work, you know, there are some people, friends and family, that you can work with, but when you push it just because they're a friend or just because they're family to work with them, you know, the problem is that you're stuck with them for life in terms of your relationship. And sometimes you let things go, you wouldn't treat them as well, and vice versa. So, I mean, I know that I've had that experience where I always say, I don't want to sit across from a table having dinner with you on a Friday night and just talk about business the whole time.
Right. Yeah, I hear you. That's very true. And I've done business with friends and it's worked out fairly well, but sometimes it doesn't.
So let's talk a little bit about your specialty here, the area of multifamily, the area of real estate, the residential. We've seen, obviously, just recently, we all know about the major failures in this area, right? That, you know, you could hopefully, you know, buy and sell and flip and refurbish and do all these things and borrow all sorts of money, but you got to know when the going's good and when the going's not good. What's going on in the residential real estate area around the country and from what your perspective is?
Well, lots of people are asking, are we in a bubble? And the question is, yeah, the answer is yes and no, because real estate is all local, right? And so where San Francisco, San Jose, Seattle, Denver, Austin, places like that, they may or may not be, but I think they're probably in a bubble. There's a lot of other places who have sound fundamentals. They have a huge demographic of people moving into the area. I don't know if you've heard the story, but apparently U-Haul has four times as many trucks traveling, loaded trucks traveling from California to Texas as it has from Texas to California. So it costs a lot more to take a U-Haul from California to Texas because people are moving into Texas. The growth there is staggering. And so places like San Antonio, Dallas, and Houston are growing hand over fist. And I don't think they're at all in a bubble, whereas other places might be. So I think it's, you know, as long as you buy right and you get the right MSA, the right city, the right submarket, you really do sound fundamentals, you don't fall in love with a property, which is something that I've been guilty of a number of times, you can make a good deal in flipping property, residential property or multifamily in lots of different markets right now.
I mean, the question about the whole exodus, well, here's the question. Are they moving to Texas or are they moving from California?
That's a great question, you know. Colorado is seeing a lot of people from California as well. Utah is, Oregon is. So I guess the answer is probably that they're moving from California.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, obviously, we always know the prices there have always been, you know, extremely high, especially in San Francisco. And I mean, all the tech areas and all the areas that you have many of these, you know, the companies that have the headquartered. We've seen a lot, you know, the San Francisco Bay Area, obviously Seattle, Austin obviously is a tech center. Then you had New York, which went on there. One of the things that I've noticed here in Florida, which again, there's different pockets of Florida, but you have Miami that for a while they were making these, I mean, you saw these incredible condos going up and you saw the prices. I mean, people, you know, when you start hearing like sealed bids or buyers stepping over each other, standing in line, or even bidding above the price. I mean, that's usually a sign of something very significant, isn't it?
Yeah, it really can be. I mean, that is happening in places like Dallas and San Antonio and Houston right now. But again, I don't think those are in a bubble because of the demographic shift. But yeah, that can be a problem, especially, you know, honestly, the states of Florida, Nevada, Arizona, and California are four states that we do not buy multifamily property in, though we love those states in lots of ways. Love Florida myself. Don't really want to own multifamily there. And I've had some guests on my podcast who have owned multifamily in Florida and single family residential in Florida. And when the crash hit last time, actually their multifamily did not go down much. It might have just suffered a tiny bit, but the single family took at least two or three of my podcasts in podcast guests from Florida down. And so really not wanting to be in a place where the price of the real estate might go up 50% over a couple years and then down 50 or 60% even in the recession like we saw there.
I mean, I could tell you that right now in Fort Lauderdale, where I live, there isn't, you know, the cranes are all over the place. And we have a couple of things that are going on. And it's pretty cool in terms of what they're doing. There's an incredible demographic shift going on here. You know, you look at the whole idea of there is a shift to a much younger group of people. There's a shift to, you know, attracting people. Whereas Fort Lauderdale for a long time was like, you would think, my grandfather would never come down and visit because he thought that when he stepped foot on the soil of Florida that he was going to drop dead.
Why?
He always thought it was the graveyard of the country.
Wow.
Right? I mean, Staten Island's the armpit of New York and Florida's the graveyard of the country. But you know, he always thought that was where you go as your final resting place. You go where there's going to be, you know, that's kind of the retirement community. That's obviously changed a lot in the last number of years. Still not a lot of industry here, but here's what's happening. You know, for a long time, there's a lot of building going on, a lot of buying going on, particularly on the east side of town in the water area. There was a tremendous, when I used to live out west, influx of an enormous amount of capital from places like Venezuela and Brazil, many of the Latin American countries. That dried up. That has totally dried up. Maybe they were very smart over the years to take money, obviously, out of those countries. But what's interesting now is the amount of rental, multifamily rental properties going up. What is going on with that?
You know, there is a I have a very long answer for this. I wrote a book called The Perfect Investment, Create Enduring Wealth from the Historic Shift to Multifamily Housing. So that whole book would actually answer your question. But to summarize it, there are about four major factors that have caused a significant shift to multifamily, and I'll try to summarize those. First of all, government tampering. In 1995, the government, in their great wisdom, thought it would be a great idea for everybody to own a home. And so they lowered the bar. Andrew, you remember it.
Oh, yeah.
If you could fog a mirror, you could get a loan. I know a guy named Jack who had about $35,000, $40,000 a year income working at an apartment complex. He bought a second home, mind you, which was a mansion in kind of an old town in West Virginia for $600,000. Second home. And he didn't have a really good plan, and he didn't make very many payments to the bank before they got it back. And so from 1995 to 2005, the home ownership rate in the U.S. went up because of the new regulations and the new push for ownership from 63% to about 69.2% to be exact. And in 2005, when it started to unwind, you might have seen the movie The Big Short. When it started to unwind, people started giving their houses back to the bank. Home ownership started plummeting again. And over the next 10 years from up to 2015, it went back to the historical norm of about 63%. But something else happened during that 10 years. People began to realize that home ownership was not their greatest investment. They saw their friends, their parents, their uncles lose homes in the recession. And they realized that, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars per clip were being evaporated overnight. So the second factor here is the millennial generation isn't real excited about home ownership. As a whole, they like the flexibility of renting. I mean, why would they tie themselves down to a 30-year contract on a seemingly overpriced home when they could move across town next year for a new job, new friends, and fun? So a lot of millennials, even if they could own, a lot of them have record student debt. Couple that with the government regulations going back to pre-1995, when you actually had to have something amazing called a down payment. So millennials aren't really excited about it. Yeah, I know.
No, but you know, so, what's interesting about this, you know, you talk about millennials. I have friends, younger friends, that and a few of them that I can think of that actually rent at above market price rents. That, in other words, they got, let's call it a two-bedroom, two-bathroom, I don't know, 1,200-square foot, which is a decent-sized apartment, right? And right. They're paying like, you know, $2,800 a month for this thing. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. You could buy a house just down the street. Probably, right. All right, on a 15-year, maybe not a 30 if you don't want to go that far. But on a 15-year, you could probably pay $2,200 a month for the same, you know, same size deal. Why are you paying more? And what is it? It's all about the flexibility, right?
Right. It really is. I mean, and they realize that it could go down, especially in places I mentioned before. The price of that home may be $100,000, $200,000 less, and they may be locked into it. Like I had a friend in San Diego who I got an MBA with. Way back in 1991, I think it was, he wanted to leave San Diego to come back to Cleveland. Not sure why. But anyway, he couldn't sell his home.
Right.
And he didn't want to give it back to the bank. So he held on till the next upturn. So, but millennials are typically not buying homes today. And every 1%, by the way, drop in home ownership translates to about 1 million new renters. Well, during the recession, there was not a lot of single family being built, as you know, but there wasn't a lot of multifamily being built as well. So there was about an 8-to-1 imbalance in the demand for multifamily versus the supply during the recession. And so a lot of people found themselves renting, doubling up, going back to their parents' basements, and not even rent, you know, finding an apartment that they wanted. So what happened is during the recession, while incomes on average went down, rents actually went up, making, again, another case for multifamily being the perfect investment because it's something that went up during good times. And it also, at least in this one case, during this recession, went up during bad times. And that's why my friend, a financial planner, said that I should entitle the book The Perfect Investment. From his point of view, it was.
You know, it's now I'm thinking about this, you know, probably one of the smartest investments you can make in terms of real estate. If you had the desire to invest in real estate, not multifamily, is to buy houses and to figure out a way to do a rent to own or a lease to own deal. Because one of these days, we know that eventually the probability is that you're going to have these millennials that are going to want to turn over and buy the house. They'll give into the fact that, you know, assuming we don't have any major crashes, everybody forgets the past, you know, and sometime in the future when they have kids, when they have the opportunity to, they want to kind of set some roots somewhere, not maybe be as, if that is something that's happening, whereas the desire for mobility is not as high as they have now, that maybe the whole concept of having these houses that you have a reasonable rental and a rent to own kind of concept in it would work. I don't know. I'm just thinking this out here.
Yeah. You know, so my friend who I mentioned, Jack, who bought the $600,000 second home, he has since then bought dozens and dozens and dozens of single family homes, and he fixes them up a little bit. He might buy it for $20,000 to $40,000. He'll fix it up a little bit. He'll have a $275 a month payment on it, and he'll rent it for $700 a month. But yeah, he'll do it on a rent-to-own basis.
Right.
Now, that means he doesn't have to take care of the maintenance. After the first 30 days, it's on the buyer, the renter buyer, that is. It also means he gets a $3,000 to $5,000 or even $10,000 down payment that's lost if the buyer, renter buyer, walks away. And get this, Andrew, 70 to 75% of the people who rent to own, even if they put a large down payment down, walk away. Jack took a $25,000 deposit on a $50,000 home the other day. And statistically, it's likely that person will eventually walk away from that home and he'll keep the money and start all over.
So wait a minute, just let's back this up for a second. So the people that don't want to necessarily buy, is this because they have no credit? They're doing this kind of deal where it's a quasi real, basically what's happening here is Jack's taking back paper, but he's doing it in a way that it's a lock.
Yeah, that's right. So he's obligating himself to sell the home to the person if they want to buy it. And I can tell you that from our discussion I had with him the other day, I think only two people have ever followed through and purchased, and that's after doing this for about 12 years. So he's had about two people purchase, and literally, I bet you literally over 100 people who have walked away. So when I said 70 to 75%, I was giving you a national average. His is actually much higher. And so here's the thing. He puts a price tag on it high enough that he'll make money if they stay in and buy, and he'll make money if they walk away. It really is a good thing if you can deal with the hassle of having a rent to own. So I always recommend that people get a property manager, pay them 5 or 6% to deal with all the hassles along the way.
I think that's really, I'm trying to wrap my hands around the whole idea of how someone will actually go into a rental and a rent to own and then put down that kind of money on that value house and then even consider doing that if they were going to walk away. But that's maybe we'll talk about that on the sidebar, because that's kind of an interesting. First of all, you got to find cheap enough housing too, which is not the easiest thing.
Right. Let me just tell you one more quick one. My business partner is a doctor, and he was selling his $400,000 home, couldn't find a buyer because it was kind of a nice house out in the sticks. He sold it to a guy from D.C. who was moving down to the Blue Ridge Mountains. He gave him a $50,000 deposit on this home, and he made a $5,000 a month payment for about 2 or 3 years, and he walked. My friend pocketed, not through his own choice, but through the buyer's choice of walking away, he pocketed $95,000, if I remember right, in that deal, and he got the house back and started over.
I mean, the only problem with that is obviously, one, if pricing of the house goes down and they don't want it, then you're stuck with it. If renters don't come in for whatever reason, I don't know what the reason is, you know, and who's responsible then for all the upkeep of the house, the roof and all that?
Yeah. So the buyer, the tenant buyer, the renter buyer is actually responsible because they're buying the home. That's the beautiful thing about it. After 30 days, it's on them if anything goes wrong. And then if they get it back, if the owner, like Jack in this case, or my doctor friend gets it back, they're responsible for whatever was done to the house while the person was in it. But, you know, surprisingly, Andrew, there's not that much bad done to these homes because these people have this belief all along that they're going to buy it. So they usually don't trash it.
You know what this reminds me of? It reminds me of the term life insurance business. Whereas I think there's some ridiculous number, I don't even know the stat, but I know it's a very large percentage of people that buy term insurance lapse the policy before any death payment is made.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, that's exactly what you're talking about here. They buy the policy for the protection. They buy the house to live in to buy it. And then they pay all these years. Nothing's ever paid out. Same thing on the other side. Nothing, you know, they never buy it. And the money just is pure profit. Well, in terms of the house, it's not pure profit because there's some cost to carry the deal.
Right.
For Jack and Doc. I like the idea though. I like it. Let's move on to another topic here. And so, you know, you did a lot of flips and subdivision development, hotels and waterfront and all that. Is still the whole idea of the one of the best places to buy is on the water because there's only so much water possible. Although I guess with global warming and climate change, a lot more water is possible, but not thinking that, okay? You know, is that still a major play? And I know that, again, I'm talking from down here in Florida. I mean, you live on the water. That price of that property is substantially higher than the thing across the street.
Yeah, so I have a website called smithmountainhomes.com, and it's a website that generates buyer leads for Smith Mountain Lake in Virginia. It's a beautiful lake. If you saw the movie What About Bob?
I love that movie.
Yeah, it was filmed here. It was not filmed at Lake Winnipesaukee in New Hampshire, but anyway, it's a beautiful lake, and beautiful Blue Ridge Mountains encircle the lake. And you may have a $150,000 house in a normal subdivision down here, but across the street on the water, that same house with, you know, a dock and a beautiful view of the mountains might be $500,000. But still, not bad compared to some places like, you know, New York, New Jersey, and California.
Right. So it's still a good thing to do is to the old adage of buy on the water because there's only so much, you know, water line available, right? Nothing changing?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So a couple of things I wanted to talk to you about is that you talk about in I think in your book and also on your podcast, is there some secrets of the super wealthy and how to attain their wealth over generations, right? You know, and all that.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about that. Explain that concept.
Well, you know, when I was at Ford Motor Company in Detroit in the late 80s, my business partner quit, my eventual business partner. And he said, you know, we're going to go out and make millions of dollars starting this business. He started and then I joined him later. He said, then we're going to have access to all kinds of investment opportunities we never could dream of now. He said, you'll see. And what I found, Andrew, is he was right. Mm. There are lots of ways that the super wealthy can perpetuate their wealth by investing in very safe, very stable, but high performing assets like storage units or like large scale multifamily or like other properties like that. And so the super wealthy have access to this, but they also, I'm just going to put this in here. I need to say it. Super wealthy also have lots of opportunities to be scammed because when we sold our company to a publicly traded firm, all of a sudden I was pretty entrepreneurial. I was only 36 years old at the time. And I, all of a sudden, this world had opened up to me, you know, to invest in tax lien certificates, which I'd never heard of, and investing in all kinds of great, so-called great things that I did not properly vet. And what I found was I started swinging for the fences. I started trying to, you know, double my money overnight. And what I found is if you play double or nothing long enough, you're going to hit nothing. And then what will you have left to double? And so that's one of the premises for my How to Lose Money podcast and my book as well.
So, you know, it's interesting because you talk about the super wealthy could do a lot of things. First of all, just to get back to storage units, every single time I use a storage unit and I go to the storage unit maybe, and I for when I was moving my house about 3 years ago, you know, I had to put my stuff in storage for, I don't know, 3-4 months. And, you know, I stood there and I'm like, oh my God, what a great business. I mean, just think about that. You just put up these sheds and people shove their stuff in there. And what do you have to do? You have a security guard and you have a front desk person and you sell locks and you know, provide the insurance. I mean, what a great business, that stuff. And some of the ones down here now, these robo vaults, have you seen these deals?
No, I haven't. Tell me about it.
So they're basically, so down here, you don't necessarily want to put, let's say, fine paintings in an outdoor, storage facility. They won't do well,
right.
You know. So they have these. You could have, of course, the indoor air conditioned style. They have these ones that are these robo vaults that basically have these giant vaults that have these robotics that pull your whole thing out and drop it down. It's kind of like in a container kind of thing.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a really cool. Big old.
That is really cool. You know, let me just say something about storage units though. When I got into multifamily investing, I chose that over storage units specifically. And here's the reason. The barriers to entry for storage units is pretty low.
Yeah.
My wife and I just drove through to see a friend the other day, way down the mountains. And we drove along a road we used to live on, and we hadn't been there in a couple of years. There were 2 new storage unit facilities on that road and former farms and pastures. And I thought, you know, if we would have invested in storage units, which I thought about doing way back in about 1999, you know, we would have been maybe next door to a big field that would have had 1,000 more storage units set up right next to me. And then what would have happened to the competition, the price? I just don't like the fact that it doesn't have very high barriers to entry around your business, which multifamily and other commercial real estate absolutely does have higher barriers to entry. No,
I agree. I mean, I just thought it would. I was taking it from the aspect of the fact that it is a low barrier to entry and how easy it is just to pop these things up. The fact that you don't have to have major construction that is anything special, and that after they're up, in theory, this is theory, that you don't have to do a damn thing. There's no upkeep. Who cares how dirty the storage unit is? You know, I mean, who cares? You know, 24 hours. Anyway.
True.
So then, let's kind of close this up on. So how does somebody get involved in? I mean, obviously, your average investor who maybe is just starting out doesn't have the ability to buy a multifamily unit just right off the beginning. How does somebody get involved in the whole real estate side of things?
So to get involved in multifamily, one way to do it is to go out and buy a duplex. And if you're a millennial, you might like the idea of house hacking. I'm a blogger on biggerpockets.com, and everybody's talking about house hacking, which is, you know, you live in one side of the duplex and you rent out the other side, and it virtually pays your mortgage, or a fourplex or whatever. And then I know a guy who actually in Dallas, Texas, who bought a duplex. He traded it up in a couple of years to a fourplex. By the way, he only put $1,000 down originally. It was back in the day, right?
Hell yeah.
Then he ended up with a 12-plex, then a 20. And when I met him, he was selling 132 units for about $9 million.
Wow.
So that's one way to do it. It's a long, hard road. It's a lot of management. It's a lot of hassle. Another way to do it is to, if you have a lot of money available, say $2, $3, $4 million, and you have great credit, a lot of net worth and liquidity, you can buy your own multifamily facility. For example, one I'm looking at right now in Lexington, Kentucky, is an $8 million purchase. You could put $3 million down, borrow $5 million, and you're off to the races. But I mentioned barriers to entry earlier. You've got to have a lot of cash available to do that. You have to have high liquidity. You have to have high net worth. You have to have a lender who believes in you, which means you're going to have experience operating a multifamily before. You're going to have commercial brokers who choose your bid over someone else they already know, who they know will close. There's a lot of barriers to entry to buying a large-scale multifamily, even if you have the money to do it. So the third way is what I recommend, and that is either partnering with another company or another person who's already been doing this, or possibly throwing your money into a syndication deal, which means there's an operator, he's experienced, he's pooling together dozens of investors at, let's say, $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 each or more, and pulling that money together to go and make that $3 million. They get the loan for $5 million. It's typically a non-recourse loan. And then all the investors are direct owners, direct fractional owners of that real estate. And the tax benefits of doing that, Andrew, are almost unbelievable. They're so good.
Right. That's definitely a tax benefit. I mean, even some of the low-income housing, I mean, there's some incredible tax benefits there. A little bit of a different concept, but still, there is some great stuff there. You know, another form of house hacking, which I never heard that term before. I like it. You know what? You have to have a good term and then everything flies. You know what I mean? Right. You know, you have to have a good term. So, but one of the ways you can house hack down here in Florida is you get a decent size and a decent property, or maybe even not. I'm not talking about a nice house. It could be any house, you know, on a deep water canal with a reasonable proximity to the port. Mm-hmm. And what you do is you make sure to get a decent sized bulkhead in the back, and seawall and dock space. And you put some boats back there and you get like $5,000 or $6,000 a month off of the boats. Now the only
Wait a minute. How many boats to get $5,000 or $6,000?
Like two biggies. So if you have, let's say, 100-foot dock, you put, you know, a 60-footer and a 40-footer there, or a 35-footer.
Wow.
Or if I know a guy who's got a corner unit and he's definitely getting probably $4,000 a month off of an 80-footer on the one side, he's probably on the other side getting, I would say, probably another $2,000. And sometimes they even stack their little ones there. But you can get a few grand on an 80-foot, let's even say a 70-foot. A 70-foot dock, you put a 50-foot boat there, you probably get a couple grand a month.
I have never heard of this before. That is amazing. You know, up here at Smith Mountain Lake in Virginia, people only spend $2,000 a year to dock their boat. So that's a foreign concept to me.
Well, how big are the boats there?
Well, they're typically 22 foot.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, you usually get $3 a foot per month or something like that, whatever it is. But here you have all these large boats with nowhere to go down here in Fort Lauderdale and in Miami. I could tell you some other stories about some you know, $2,000, $3,000 a day dockage down in Miami.
Wow.
You know, but seriously, you can get that down here. And because you have, especially on the New River where I am, because one of the things you have is on one side, if you go out to the port, which is, you know, let's call it a 20-foot, you can go, I guess, up the river a bit, but there's no bridges, a big issue about bridges, no problem with bridges, but you go down, it's like, let's say 30 minutes to the port, let's just say. Okay, not a long ride, not a big deal, 30 minutes. On the other side, if you go down the other way, there are all the big facilities to handle all the repairs and maintenance on the big boats. So you're right in between. So wow. I know a house on the corner of my block that's for sale, well over the rest of the houses. It was like $3.25 million. Okay, mm-hmm. I'm like, oh my gosh, wait a minute. The house next door is maybe worth $600,000, $700,000, right? Mm-hmm. And this one on the corner, why is that? Well, because they have a corner lot. They have 100 foot of dock space on one side, another 50 foot on the other side. And they got a big boat there, like an 80 foot something or other jobby boat there. They're getting a lot of money from that. They got another boat on the other side. They're probably getting, you know, so they're probably getting somewhere in the neighborhood of, I would say, I'm just going to even be, let's just say they get $5,000 a month. Let's just say that number. Okay. Total. Mm-hmm. And the other guys pay their their electric and all the other stuff, right? You get $5,000 a month. How much is that in terms of the valuation of a house of income right off of that? Forget about the house. Mm-hmm. So you can put an extra $1 million on the price tag.
Yeah, I would think so. I would think it would be about a 20-to-1 ratio or more. So I think you're right, about $1 million.
Yep. So pretty cool. Anyway, Paul Moore, Wellings Capital Podcast, How to Lose Money. We'll make sure to put all of the links for biggerpockets.com, smithmountainhomes.com, all the different places that people can reach you on episode number 523 of the disciplinedinvestor.com on the show notes page. We'll make sure to have it there. And thank you for joining us. Really interesting stuff.
It's been great, Andrew. Thank you so much for having me on today.
All right, Paul, we'll do it again. Thanks.
All right.
And I want to take a moment to express my best wishes and hope for only good things. All the people that are affected by Hurricane Harvey around the Texas area and coastline as well as inland. Anybody that's been affected, we're just hoping for the best for you. And of course, wish you a very safe time with all this crazy rainfall and winds and all that that's going on. But by the way, just to let everybody know, it's not just the people in Texas that are affected by this hurricane. You and you, me, we're all affected no matter where we are, because we've already seen a major spike in gasoline prices. Now, whether or not this will continue will depend on really what the damage is to many of the refineries and facilities inside of the area, because there is in the whole area that was hit, the ground zero, we'll call it, for the hurricane, there are a tremendous amount of refineries and oil facilities related to oil, as well as chemical facilities right there. And we've already seen a major move on gasoline prices, and all depend on how much rain, because the rain is really the biggest issue right now in terms of flooding, of how it affects the operations of many of these facilities. And that's going to affect all of us. So while oil prices, this is kind of interesting. Last week, if you notice, oil prices dropped Thursday and Friday. I think they were up slightly on Friday, but they were down pretty good. And it was a bit of a head scratcher thinking, wait a minute, this hurricane is barreling right into the areas where there is oil rigs. And back in years past, you would have think that, wow, that would really affect oil prices. And it didn't. In the meantime, you saw gasoline prices spiking. One of the things is that we have a much more decentralized area for oil production, and there's still not as much of a diversified area for refinement. And that was one of the reasons why that we're seeing a significant spike in gasoline prices. So this hurricane is going to be far-reaching. Again, depending on how this plays out, there's some models that have talked about it's going to go inland as a 3 or a Category 4 hurricane, create a lot of wind damage, but the rain is somewhere in, like, you know, anywhere from 15 to 25 or even more inches of rain over the next several days, because the storm is going to stall out, and being such a strong storm, it's not just going to dissipate. Then there are further models that have this thing moving inland up towards kind of towards Houston a little bit, and then coming back into the water, gaining strength again, and then getting kicked back into that whole Corpus Christi, Galveston area again, and just pounding the area with more rain throughout the next several days. Talking about a hurricane that hit Friday night and possibly massive rain that's going to continue in the area through Wednesday. I mean, think about that time. they're going to get, some of these areas are going to get a year's worth of rain in 4 or 5 days. That is definitely going to overload their system, create a lot of flooding, damage due to water damage, which is very difficult. Of course, wind damage is a problem also, but water damage, you know, this could be a very serious situation for many of not only the people there, but the businesses as well. And because of all the refining that's done, we could see a possibility of a shutdown of many of these refining facilities that will have the gas move higher. So, again, our best wishes are to everybody there for your safety and for the safety of you and your loved ones, your belongings and all that, of course. But also, many of us are going to see some big effects on this as well. So this is a big one, pretty big. Last thing I want to talk about is the recent announcement by Amazon that the deal with Whole Foods closed last week, and they already announced just before on the consummation of this deal, which is going to be on Monday. So the deal kind of closed. It's going to be finalized on Monday coming up. That on Monday already, they're set to slash food prices at their Whole Foods facilities. And that caused a major headache for many of the grocers. United Natural Foods, Target took a hit, Walmart took a hit, Costco took a hit. Kroger got smoked, down about 8% on that news. Tried to recover a little bit the next day when people thought it was a bit of an overreaction. But if you think about this, they're aggressively, and don't forget about all the money that Amazon has in order to break many of these grocers. They have money in their coffers. They don't really care about maybe some losses for the next couple of years at Whole Foods, because their goal is to make it a much bigger, much more traffic, much more delivery. They're going to add delivery. They're going to do, you know, have lockers there. They're going to do all these things with these. Now they have all these retail establishments. So going to watch this and what the effect is going to be on this. You know, they call it the Amazon effect on retail. And this is going to be very interesting to see how the grocers, and in particular the Walmarts and the Targets of the world, are able to compete in this kind of an environment where they are going to be pressing down prices in order to bring people in order to really juice up the entire Amazon brand. Now, a few weeks ago, I mentioned that on the initial drop when the news came out, we actually bought Target, United Natural Foods, and Kroger. Sold those for a nice profit, sat on the sideline. Question is, are we going to get back into this as they are now hitting their lows again? I don't think so. Because now the first was a sell on the news and a reaction to this very big surprise. The second one was a reaction to the reality. And now I think there's going to be some very big concern about getting back into that space by a lot of investors, because they'd rather wait to see what's going on over the next period of time. So keep an eye on those names, because I think it's going to tell a lot about what's happening in the world of retail. All right, we're going to end it there. Again, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I will let you know real quickly, just a quick end of show, if you're still listening and still awake, that Investology next week will be open for business. We went through the beta. Everything's great. Don't go there yet. I'll let you know when to go. Sit tight. I'll tell you the website. I'll tell you all about it probably next week or so. But it's going to be open for business about a week and a half, right after Labor Day. It will be available. We'll talk a little bit more about that on an upcoming show. But until then, make sure to listen next week as we have Damon Southard, who is a cryptocurrency trader. We're going to have Vitaly Katsanelson on shortly. Lots of good things on the show coming up. Thanks again for listening. I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.